Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Tribune podcast. This week we discuss Schalke, the Royal Blues, and whether they are the true sleeping giants of the Bundesliga. Today I'm joined by Ross Dunbar and Alex Chaffer to discuss this topic and perhaps figure out why the Royal Blues aren't as successful as other teams in the German top division. So guys, I think the best way to really just jump straight into this is just to put the facts out on the table for people who perhaps don't follow the league as thoroughly as we do, and perhaps aren't really aware of any of the clubs outside Dortmund and Bayern. We should really put these facts on the table. So the ones that really stood out for me, first off, was just the sheer amount of fans that Schalke have. The club claim to have just under 130,000 registered fans in Germany, and which makes them the second largest club in Germany and the third largest in the world. And that number has gone up from 10,000 to 130,000 since 1991. The club also have huge amounts of resources, which, you know, again, casual fans might not be aware of. They have the 13th highest revenue in world football, according to Deloitte's regular financial reports. And that's moving up from one place the following year. And they've also no longer have any debt. They cleared off their debt from August 2014. Now, these are all just numbers, obviously, and there's a lot more to football than just numbers. But Ross, this definitely gives the suggestion that Schalke have the resources to be challenging the very best teams in the Bundesliga, such as their bitter rivals Dortmund and Bayern Munich.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, like, you know, the raw foundations, I think Schalke are certainly the club that could put up a threat to Bayern and Dortmund's duopoly. You know, it's an interesting one with Schalke because I think the biggest facet to this discussion is that Schalke is still a member association. Dortmund and Bayern, of course, are on the stock market. They trade like normal businesses, but Schalke is owned by its members, and from what I can gather, that's how they want it to be for the foreseeable future. Dortmund, of course, in recent years, I mean, obviously it's best not to compare them to Bayern because there's still a massive gulf there, but if you compare them to Dortmund, their local rivals, Dortmund, they released an extra 100 million shares or whatever in 2014, and I think they made something like 140 million euros at that point, and that's obviously was a big factor in them being able to spend the kind of money that they did on Aubameyang, Mkhitaryan and Immobile. Less said about Immobile, the better, of course. But Schalke have never really ventured into that area of business. I mean, like I said, the club is still owned by its members, and that has a lot of disadvantages. We've seen that clubs like Hamburg have decided to spin off all their football operations into a business. You wonder if that's something that Schalke would consider in years to come, because clearly that is the biggest obstacle financially to Schalke competing with Bayern and Dortmund when it comes to finances. I mean, like you say, they own the majority of the stadium. I think they're aiming to pay that off by about 2020. They had to make a lot of refurbishments to the roof a few years ago, which cost them a little bit extra money. In terms of the debt, they want to pay that off by 2019. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, like you said, the raw foundations are there for the club. But for me, that's still one of the biggest kind of caveats there. And you kind of wonder if that tradition is kind of holding them back a little bit. I mean, I don't know what you guys think about that. I mean, if you're looking at it from a business perspective, is this something that Schalke has to overcome?
Yeah, I think looking at in terms of money, you see that Schalke, their record transfer, their fees paid was Klaas-Jan Huntelaar for 14 million euros, and although they're still being able to compete in terms of getting into Europe every year, a need to sort of spend money and try and push on and sort of buy the players that Bayern and Dortmund are now able to do is evident. They have the best youth academy in Germany, I think, personally. The players that they've produced over the last few years, likes of Leroy Sané, Max Meyer, even the ones who have left, like Julian Draxler or Mesut Ozil or Manuel Neuer, they've produced so many good talents, but it just seems like they've, as on the pitch, as obviously I'm speaking about, they've just not been able to compete as well with Dortmund and Bayern. And in terms of who has been selected to become a manager, or maybe who has been wrongly selected is the better way of saying it, it's become such a problem for them that they've had so much potential on the pitch with a lot of players coming in and out, but they've just never been able to fulfil it. And I'd agree with you, Ross, that in terms of pushing away from the traditional sort of style that Schalke has, although it still seems like a sort of much more modern club with like the Gazprom deal and stadiums and so on, they need to maybe look into investing a bit more and trying to really push to compete, because the likes of Wolfsburg spending big, Bayer Leverkusen are going to start doing it in the next few years, I think. These teams around them are being able to produce more money and spend it, and Dortmund and Bayern are pushing on even further and going further ahead. So Schalke need to do more work to compete with that, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, just touching again back on that point about the Members Association. I mean, obviously, as I said about Hamburg and other clubs moving towards that kind of model, you know, I don't think we can really understate how big a barrier that is to Schalke dealing financially, because, you know, the club obviously, you know, at the moment is making revenue of about 280 million, 270 million, that kind of money. I think actually this year it was about 220, so I think it was down in the previous year. I think Schalke, if they were to, let's say, you know, sell off maybe 20% of this member control, they could easily make, you know, 60, 70 million euros, I think, on the stock market, just for that small chunk of ownership. And I think when you compare it to Dortmund obviously have a lot of strategic partners like Puma, Evonik, Signal Iduna. All of these partners have ownership in the club. And it's exactly the same with Bayern. Bayern obviously have given Aldi and Adidas quite a prominent say on the board, and Schalke haven't really done that. The Gazprom deal is as close as it gets, really, to Schalke having that kind of long-term partner. And if they did decide to break down that barrier of the association thing, I think quite quickly you would see them being able to invest in transfers. A couple of other things I'd like to point out as well, like, you know, if you look at the revenue gap this year, the revenue gap is between Bayern and Dortmund. Sorry, between Dortmund and Schalke, is somewhere in the region of about 60 million euros, which is quite a big gap between two competing clubs. Dortmund, of course, weren't in the Champions League, so I think we can negate that factor. Dortmund obviously have a pretty sizable matchday revenue. There's a 20 million matchday revenue gap there, and I think we probably will touch on it. Of course, you know, the fact that Schalke really need to qualify for the Champions League every season. Of course, this year that's not going to happen. They're going to be playing in the Europa League. Financially, it's not a massive problem because they budget for the Europa League. This is, and again, I think that's a big difference between Bayern and Dortmund, between Dortmund and Schalke, sorry, is that Dortmund really need to qualify for the Champions League to maintain such a high level of performance. But Schalke, okay, they not qualifying for the Champions League is a huge blow given the financial lucratives that could bring, but the Europa League is what they're targeting almost financially, the way that the club is set up in terms of repaying debt and whatever. Europa League is what they're targeting, but I think if they want to bridge that gap, they have to qualify for the Champions League.
That's an interesting stance you've taken on this, Ross, because although I agree with your points, I mean, you've fantastically broke down, you know, the advantages that Bayern and Dortmund have in terms of trading on the stock exchange and why Schalke, to a certain extent, are held back in that regard, at least when we compare them to Dortmund. What kind of strikes me when I kind of dig into the setup of Schalke isn't the lack of money they're making. In fact, I think they're making more than enough money. The Gazprom deal, as you said, the new one, it's about 150 million euros, I think it is, over the next 5 years. And they've also got a very lucrative deal with Huawei. I think that's the way you pronounce it, the Chinese phone company. I can't remember how you pronounce it. So they do still sell their advertising regionally, locally, nationally, and internationally, like Bayern and Dortmund do. They might not have these companies on their board because they're not members of the club, but I still think they do relatively trade and sell themselves in a relatively similar way. I mean, sure, we can say that they're not making as much money as Dortmund and Bayern, and there's a number of reasons behind that, but that's not an excuse for me. The most recent financial results show that they're making more money than AC Milan. They're making more money than Inter Milan. They're making more money than Everton. They're making more money than Atletico Madrid, who are going to be in this season's Champions League final and have a very good chance of beating Real Madrid in the Champions League final. Now, I'm not saying Atletico Madrid are a fair example because they've clearly been playing beyond their expectations, perhaps. But I don't think Schalke can hide behind the fact that they're not making as much money as Dortmund as to why they're not challenging for titles. I think they have more than enough money. I think the problem is the people who are running the club, which is something we can move on to now, because we've spoke about the finances, but whenever you look at Schalke, there's particularly perhaps one man who seems to be in front of the cameras or doing interviews with the newspaper, and that's, of course, Horst Held. And Ross, this is a man who has been at the club for quite some time. I think it's now 10 years, perhaps. He's leaving this summer. He's going to be replaced by another sporting director. But how would you say Held's time at Schalke has been, and whether or not you think he has held the club back?
I think when it comes to you know, a sporting sense, I think, yeah, they probably have been held back. I mean, I'm looking at some of the numbers now in terms of the signings that they've made, and I just want to, just obviously for background, I want to reel off some of the signings that they've made. You know, obviously Horst Held came in 2011. They bought Sinead Uwabasi from Hoffenheim for $4.5 million. They bought Cyprian Marika, Timo Pukki, and Marco Huger for a combined $2 million. 2012, they spent $2 million on two loan deals for Rafael and Michel Bastos. 2013, they spent $8 million on Adam Chalai from Mainz, who had, I think, scored something like 13 goals the season before. Christian Clemens cost $3 million. Felipe Santana was $1 million. And Kevin Prince-Boateng was $10 million. 2014, Sidney Sam was $2.5 million. Matija Nastasic was $10 million. 2015, Franco Di Santo was $6 million. Junior Kaikara was $4.5 million. Johannes Geis was $10 million, and Pierre Emile Højbjerg was $1 million on a loan deal. So I make it at around €60 million worth of talent that Schalke have brought in, excluding, of course, signings maybe like Ralf Fährmann coming in from the youth team, etc. Christian Fuchs, who came in from Mainz. But €60 million worth of talent in, say, 5 years. And out of all those names, you'd be really hard-pushed to find a success in terms of an asset that they bring in and they can sell them on for, you know, a pretty substantial amount of money. I mean, Kevin Prince-Boateng, for example, will have cost maybe, I don't know, €5, €6, €7 million per year on wages alone. I mean, it's an incredible outlay on one player who just hasn't delivered. The only one there would be Johannes Geis and Nastasic. Nastasic has been injured for the whole season, but I think certainly he has the potential to be a really good player. And in terms of outlays, obviously that's beset by the fact that they sold Manuel Neuer for around, I think, €30 million. They sold Julian Draxler for €36 million, and they sold Papadopoulos to Leverkusen for €6 million. So essentially, without wanting to sound like I'm defending Held, because I'm really not, I think financially and in an economic sense, they haven't wasted a ridiculous amount of cash, because they've brought most of it back in on two players. So that's how he'll probably justify it. However, I think when you look at those signings, there doesn't strike any kind of balance. You don't really look at that list of signings and see a philosophy. Do you know what I mean? Whereas you look at Dortmund over the years, Dortmund, of course, don't have the same kind of youth setup that Schalke have. Schalke obviously bring through a lot of these young players from 16, 17 years old. Dortmund don't really have that kind of foundation. They've just been very good at scouting players. You know, Marcel Schmelzer, for example, came in on the cheap. Shinji Kagawa came in on the cheap. You know, so I think looking at that, I'd have to say that they could be doing a lot better in terms of the recruitment. And I think that's certainly the interesting thing about Christian Heidel coming in the summer.
Yeah, I think moving on to Heidel is very important, because you mentioned a few names there, like Adam Chalai, Christian Fuchs, Johannes Geis, Choupo-Moting, all coming from Mainz. And obviously it's a completely different situation for Mainz, because they're a much smaller club with a much smaller budget, and they have to sell their key players when that big money sort of comes in. But the fact that Mainz have been able to sell those big players and still be in the top six or seven of the Bundesliga this year, with signings like Cordoba or Amuto, or players like that, even like Bunga in the middle of defence, isn't the best player, but he came from Schalke for a very small fee. It's just, I think he's obviously done a fantastic job with Mainz with the budget he's had, and I'll be very interested to see how Heidel does with a much larger budget compared to Mainz at Schalke, and whether he can make better signings, because looking at those signings that you pointed out, Ross, there's very few there, like you said, maybe Johannes Geis, really, who has been a success at the club, to be honest. So I'm looking at Christian Heidel now and thinking that with a little bit more money to spend, it could be a little bit more pressure on him. It probably will be in terms of like having to sign the right players and not spending too much. But I'm very confident that he is the right man, or a better man than Horst Held, for the job in terms of trying to push Schalke on with signings. Because to be honest, looking at those signings, they really haven't made enough, I don't think, to really push on. Like loan signings, I think it was in 2012 you said a couple of loan signings with Raphael and Bastos. I mean, how are you going to compete with Dortmund and Bayern if you're just signing a couple of players on loan? And while they're doing that, they're selling key players like Neuer and Draxler every couple of years or so. So I think for Schalke, it's very important that Christian Heidel is able to deal with the pressure and the sort of chaos that sort of goes on behind Schalke's closed doors.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to be quite critical of Held here. I genuinely think he's done absolutely nothing, if I'm honest with you, since he arrived at Schalke. At least in pushing the club beyond where they already perhaps were when he arrived. The only signings that I can think of, like you said, is Johannes Geist, and every man and his dog in the league knew how good he was, and a number of the clubs were interested in signing him. When you look at Schalke over the last 5 or 6 years, the players who've stood out for them are the ones who've came through the youth system, or at least arrived at the club from a very young age. Goretzka and Max Meyer are two examples of that in the current team. Sure, Goretzka joined the club under Held's leadership, but he was another young player who every single coach in Germany was well aware of. And these guys have benefited from a youth system which has been in place at Schalke long before Held joined. And to me, it just seems as though Held has thrown a whole load of manure on this first team. Manure, perhaps a useful word for perhaps a ruder word I would have perhaps used. And it just so happens that, you know, a few grass shoots are still are coming through anyway. We have basically the Schalke team is a dysfunctional mess, but it just so happens that because they're Schalke, there's always young players coming through who are willing to pick up the buck and push on. Ross, your point about the money that he's made back is a good one, but that again proves my point that 60 million that they may have made back were Manuel Neuer and Julian Draxler. And Draxler, for example, despite the club's best efforts to derail his career in terms of the absolute circus that surrounded him while he was at Schalke, they still managed to sell for a profit. So I think Held has come into this team. He's wasted money, not a huge amount of money, but he's thrown money around with his scattergun approach without very much success. And this youth system has still carried on despite his best efforts, it would seem. And that seems to be the only real leg that Schalke can stand on right now. And Alex, as you quite correctly point out, they've done very well to bring in Christian Heidel, who can hopefully be a little more surgical and efficient with the transfer money that Schalke surely must have, but it isn't far off that of Dortmund. You know, to really actually engage this team and to bring in players who can actually push the team forward. I mean, we haven't even spoken about the managers who have come and gone in Held's time. But even just looking at the way that the squads have been put together during his time suggests that there's no rhyme or reason to it. And while he's running around with his hair on fire at Schalke, the youth team has continued to push players through and save his ass on a number of occasions.
No, I think that's a fair point. And again, I obviously it's best to make the comparison between Dortmund and Schalke rather than Bayern. And as I said, I think Schalke have that really raw asset in terms of the fact that they keep bringing through young players. I mean, I'm certainly not crediting Held for it, but if you look at the list of young talents that have come through at Schalke in that kind of 5 year period, you know, it's quite an impressive list. Even obviously when Neuer left, they brought in Ralf Fährmann. When Draxler left, they brought in Sané. So they've obviously got that asset there. But yeah, as I said earlier, I think there's no real cohesion in the signings that they have made. I mean, You know, why you know, they've spent €6 million is what, almost, you know, about 40% of Schalke's record transfer fee, and that's what they spent on Franco Di Santo. You know, I mean, that's pretty ridiculous, to be honest. And obviously, it's worth mentioning before Helt came in that they spent €14 million on Klaas-Jan Huntelaar, they spent €11 million on Juan Jurado, and they spent ten on Jefferson Farfán a few years earlier. A lot of that, I think, was down to, you know, such high positionings in the decade before, and obviously the fact they got to the Champions League semi-final. That was a massive help to them, and the new stadium and all the benefits that brought in. But I think you're beginning to see all of that kind of balance out a little bit, you know, obviously with all the benefits of the new stadium, the commercial deals from Gazprom is obviously balanced by the fact that their personnel costs are going up, their managerial costs are going up, all the money that they're spending on broadening the club internationally, that's costing the club as well. So I think Heidel certainly just has to be much shrewder in terms of recruitment. I mean, there's a term, recruitment is everything in football, and I think going forward they have to find players who have got potential, who've got development potential, but they also need players who can deliver instantly. And I think that's what you can give a lot of credit to Dortmund for in the last 3 or 4 years, when they have brought in all this money through extra shares. They've spent it largely, they've spent it wisely. Okay, Immobile was a bit of a disaster. In fact, it was a disaster. Let's not make any bones about it. But Aubameyang, I mean, Aubameyang was what, 13, 14 million, was it, potentially, something like that? And now he potentially is a 30, 40, 50 million euro player. You look at Henrik Mkhitaryan, they spent about 20 million on him. But they knew, they were convinced that Mkhitaryan was the guy who was going to make the difference. I mean, I've not seen any signings that Schalke have made in that time, in the last 5, 6 years, that would even come close to that. So if they want to qualify for the Champions League, they have to buy quality, because, you know, you look at a team like Leverkusen, for example, and Leverkusen is probably a good example of a club that has a really outstanding structure in place. I mean, I know that Leverkusen got a lot of stick for the lack of tradition and the lack of fan base and stuff like that, but when it comes to Rudi Völler and Jonas Boll, the two of them have been outstanding in the players that they've brought in. Someone like Charles Aránguiz has come in, outstanding player. Obviously, he's been injured for most of the season, but he will come good, I think. Julian Brandt came in from Wolfsburg, for example, on the cheap. I mean, what a deal that looks to be. Chicharito's come in, you know, just hours after the fact that they sold Song Heung-min to Spurs, and everyone thought, okay, you know, they've sold their best player to Spurs on like the second last day of the transfer window, but they brought in Chicharito and they brought in Kevin Campbell. I mean, that's great management, and I don't think Schalke worked like that. And it'd be interesting to see if Heidel can change that.
To kind of get a rounder perspective on this topic, I was fortunate enough to speak to Uli Hesse, who is the author of the fantastic encyclopedia, perhaps, of German football, the history of German football, a novel called Tor, the story of German football, which any Bundesliga fanatic must surely have in his bookcase. If you don't, then I can only urge you to buy it. And I spoke to him about the significance of Schalke's history, their success in the 30s, 40s and 50s. And then we moved on to talk about the rivalry with Dortmund and how that has come to define Schalke as one of the biggest clubs in German football to date.
Okay, well, Uli, I think from what you've wrote in your novel Tor, I think one of the most intriguing aspects of the book is when you talk about Schalke in the early years, and specifically that famous team of the 30s, which translated in English perhaps means the spinning tops. Could you perhaps dive into that era of the club a little, and how significant that team was at the time?
Yeah, well, what I don't mention in the book, actually, it's just because, you know, you can't talk about everything, is where that actually came from, which is a fascinating thing in itself, because Schalke were not the first working class team, but they were the first really, really successful working class team. You know, players from very humble origins, representing an industrial part of the country. But they did it with a very unusual style of football, a very progressive style of football. And that came about because there was not many Schalke fans would like to hear this, but there was a family that was probably originally from Dortmund. They moved to England. You know, most sources just say Britain. So, but I think it was England, but may have been Scotland even, I don't know. So they emigrated to Great Britain. And then the First World War broke out, and they were interned And after the war ended, they were sent back to Germany. And that's how the two young boys of the family, you know, grown up in Britain, suddenly ended up in Germany. And they'd grown to love football in England. And they joined a fledgling Schalke team. And what they brought with them was not just, how should we say, it was not just, you know, football was obviously a lot more advanced in Britain than it was in Germany at the time. It didn't just bring a certain, you know, certain knowledge of the game and an insight into the game, but also a totally new style. Because at that time, in the 20s, they both came over in 1920, still very much two different approaches to football. And one was known as the Scottish game, and the other was known as the English game. And the English game is what later came to be known, you know, later was denounced as kick and rush, which is, you know, a perfectly honourable approach. You know, you belt the ball upfield and you try to find your centre forward with a cross. But the Scottish game was a short passing game. You know, it's think tiki taka, if you will. So, and that's the sort of football that the two brothers brought with them to Schalke. And by a really, really one of those strange twists of fate, they were called Ballmann, which is ballmen in English, you know, that was their name. They introduced this sort of football, so they radically changed the way Schalke played the game. They kept the ball on the ground and they played an oft bewildering succession of short passes, of course, you know, relatively speaking for the time, of course. But that's where the nickname came from. To this day, I think it's don't really know whether the term spinning top, whether that referred to, you know, how quickly the ball was moving on the ground, or whether, you know, how opposing players reacted to it, you know. They always had to turn around to find out where the ball was going.
I mean, it's interesting from my own perspective. Growing up in Glasgow, I supported Queen's Park, which are not a team that are relatively well known now, but at that time period, they're a very large club in Scotland, and their nickname is the Spiders because they are largely credited with inventing the passing game in Scotland. And reading your book, I couldn't help but wonder, or perhaps fantasize, that they may have played a part in Schalke's origin, but like you said, it's very hard to pin down where that influence comes from. But from from that point on, you could say that Schalke's influence on the German game was astounding.
It was probably they probably had a bigger influence off the pitch. The big team of 1920s were Nuremberg. 30s Schalke became the dominating team, and that was, like I said, one fascinating thing about that team is that, you know, they came to represent the working man, and they were hugely popular all across the Ruhr Valley. You know, all those heated rivalries that we now have in the Ruhr Valley, they didn't quite exist because Schalke was so much better than anyone else. And most people who lived there, whether it was Dortmund or Bochum or Oberhausen or Duisburg, they all became Schalke fans. The fascinating thing is that they did it with football that was totally, you know, the total opposite of what you would expect, you know, the first really top working class team in Germany to deliver. You know, instead they played some sort of artistic, unusual, progressive football. But it was very hard to copy for the same reason that this approach is still hard to copy. You know, I mean, if you want to play like Barcelona, it's a really great help if you have good players, you know, who can execute this sort of thing. So that was one thing that why it wasn't totally copied Schalke style. One is that you need really, really good players. And the other is that, which is also still the case, I mean, not as strongly as it used to be maybe 15 or 20 years ago, it was the sort of football that, you know, if it goes wrong, people would blame it on the style, you know? All that passing around, you know? Why don't you become just more direct? And, you know, if Arsene Wenger fails at Arsenal, you know, if they don't win a title, it's always because of his, you know, fudgy-dudgy football. Criticised that style of game. And it was, or some people, I think, may even have viewed it as not a German approach. You know, traditionally, especially in the north of Germany, the style of football there was always very much influenced by England. They had you know, those attacking kick and rush sides. So it wasn't that Schalke's style became widely copied. They even had some of their leading players even had some problems when they played for the national team, because the then national coach Otto Nerz was a big fan of English football, and he didn't like this Scottish passing game very much. They were immensely influential off the pitch, because, like I said, it was, you know, after the First World War, football in Germany really became the working man's game. You needed a team that would represent that, you know. And when Schalke, during the 30s, Schalke was pretty much the team for simple working class people.
So we have this club who have, you know, developed into, as you said, a style, an icon maybe, or influence of the working class people. And they're winning championships. They're having a huge influence on the national team through the 30s and early 40s. But then, perhaps all of a sudden, and correct me if I'm wrong here, their success almost comes to an abrupt halt, at least in terms of Bundesliga titles. Would that be, now, is that simply because Bayern then came upon the scene, or is there something a little more indirect to it?
Well, of course, you know, they won their titles long before the Bundesliga came into being.
Yeah.
And they were beginning to have problems after the end of the war, and because before the Bundesliga was established, we had regional leagues, and then the Oberliga West, where Schalke were based in the West, was number one. It was very, very competitive. At that time, most of the really, really good clubs came from the West, from the west of the country. So Schalke would always have problems because they were playing in a very, very competitive league. But it was also because immensely talented crop of players. And, of course, they play together for as long as they're capable of doing it. And then suddenly it turns out that they're too old. So Schalke definitely, after the war, they had an age problem. There was they needed to rebuild, and it took them a while. It was probably, some people go as far as saying that there was a famous game in 1947 for the local championship of Western Germany between Schalke and Dortmund, and Dortmund won that game, and the newspapers on the next day, they did not headline a Dortmund champions of Western Germany, they headlined Schalke no longer champions of Western Germany, because they had dominated that for so long. But that game was really, it's gone down in football lore in this part of the country, in Western Germany, because it was the moment when there was suddenly a second team that could really challenge Schalke. Schalke were a bit overaged in that final. And for the next years, it took them a while to rebuild. And then they had a second period of, well, of course, not as excellent as it was in the 30s. But they won another title in 1958, and they played in the European Cup, and they had a good team then. But what happened then, I think, is a story that, well, happened almost all across the country, that with the introduction of the Bundesliga, that some clubs were beginning to struggle. And many of them tended to be based in the western part of the country. You know, there was a time when the Ruhr Valley had a lot of teams in the Bundesliga, and Dortmund did really well. They were the last national champions before the introduction of the Bundesliga. And Essen had a really good team in the late 50s, like Schalke did. When the Bundesliga was formed, the cards were just dealt new. And it became really difficult for clubs like, for those working men's clubs, not only Schalke, but also Dortmund, to keep abreast with other teams, mainly financially, because they had the big steel and coal crisis in the Ruhr Valley in the late 50s and then all through the 60s. And you know, by the time the 70s came around, it was the Ruhr area was, you know, the clubs were all struggling.
It's interesting that you mention that Dortmund game, because I think the rivalry between the two clubs, the Riviera Derby, seems to be a constant throughout Schalke's history. And what I find quite interesting is when you go on Schalke's Wikipedia page, they show you their results with Dortmund, or at least their rankings compared to Dortmund, long before they actually show their own honours or, you know, the trophies that they've won. So, I mean, when perhaps comparing it to maybe Bayern, who are relatively isolated in Germany in terms of geography, how much do you think Dortmund's either success or lack of success has defined how much success Schalke can have?
I think Dortmund is pretty much a thorn in their flesh right now, but for different reasons. Another reason is very hard to describe or to categorize, if you will. Number one is that normally when you have such a heated rivalry, at least in Germany, there is some sort of fundamental difference between the clubs. You know, you get a posh club like Hamburg, and you know those irreverent punk rockers at St. Pauli or whatever, or you have posher Bayern and the more working class 1860 or whatever. But with Dortmund Schalke, it's almost as if they're too similar. It took a long time for the rivalry to really take off. That 47 game may have played a smaller role, but only a small role, because during the Oberliga era, I did a book about the history of Borussia Dortmund's fans. So we spoke to, it's an oral history book, we spoke to literally countless people. And the older ones all told us that during the Oberliga era, before the Bundesliga came into being in 1963, the big rivalry was between Cologne and Dortmund. They said because, number one, Cologne and Dortmund were usually fighting for the Oberliga West title. And number two, Cologne were, they played all in white. They had a lot of money. They were very posh. And Dortmund, was stoutly working class. So that was the big rivalry they had. And then, like I said, then the Bundesliga came around, and slowly, but irrevocably, or it seemed irrevocably at the time, the Ruhrvalley clubs just fell by the wayside. And I think that made the rivalry really strong, because from, say, the early 70s on, there wasn't much else. this became the really, really big game for Dortmund and Schalke fans about silverware, and they knew they were not going to win the league. So this was the game. This became the game you had to win. So it was probably starting in the late 60s. There was a famous derby in Dortmund where there was a pitch invasion. And the dogs, the guard dogs were let loose and they bit two Schalke players. So that was, in a way, that was a bit of a symbolic game because, number one, it was really suddenly violent. And obviously Schalke didn't like that one bit. But also because when you see footage, the reason for the pitch invasion is that the place was totally crowded, and it was Schalke and Dortmund fans mingling, This would have been unthinkable 3 or 4 years later. Mm. But at the time in the late 60s, it was still possible. But then, that derby sort of marked the point from where on this, the two clubs would become the best of enemies, really. Schalke may, as I said, thorn in the flesh. That's maybe mainly because Dortmund are fiendishly successful. What I was going to say is, when I grew up, both clubs were roughly on the same level. And I recall when I went to Dortmund to the 1989 Cup final, it was really a surprise that there were people on the train saying, "We're going to win the Cup today." Because, I thought, Dortmund are never going to win anything, that's not sort of the reason they play football. And then Dortmund suddenly had a huge renaissance, and Schalke are pretty much still waiting for theirs.
I that's an interesting analogy or story, because I think, the whole point of the show today is to kind of discuss, or at least to talk to casual fans of the league who have maybe grown up enjoying the league over the last 10, 15 years. And, unless you actually dig under the surface of the Bundesliga, you could be forgiven for thinking that Schalke aren't one of the biggest clubs in Germany, despite the fact that, in terms of fan support, they're maybe second only to Bayern, at least registered fans anyway. And so, just to kind of perhaps conclude here, considering the way that you've studied the history of the league, the Bundesliga, and the championship before that, do you think that Schalke have underperformed, at least since that initial period of success before the 50s, considering their size and their influence in Germany and German football?
You know, this really is the $1 million question. Because on the one hand, obviously, you would say, well, that's what I mean about Dortmund. When you look at Dortmund and then look at Schalke, then you would have to say, you know, all that silverware which Dortmund have won in the last, you know, since the mid-90s. And well, Schalke did, you know, they did have a UEFA Cup win in 1997, so let's not forget that. But compared to what Dortmund have achieved, then you would probably have to say that Schalke have underachieved. Because as you said, they are such a massive, still a massive club. On the other hand, you might as well look at Dortmund and say that Dortmund have overachieved tremendously, and they should, by all rights, be roughly on a level with Schalke. Because the strange thing about the Bundesliga is that we have all these sleeping giants, you know, the clubs that should be much bigger. They should be proper rivals for Bayern Munich, you know, clubs like Hamburg or Hertha Berlin, or clubs from really, really big cities where there's a lot of money and there's a lot of, you know, local businessmen willing to help the clubs like Stuttgart, who are probably going down now, or Frankfurt, you know. By comparison, Dortmund and Schalke are based in a very, very poor region of the country, you know, and there's lots of problems here with unemployment and everything. So it's really difficult to say whether Schalke have really underachieved during the Bundesliga era. What they've certainly lacked was stability. I mean, if you've seen scenes on the weekend, like when the crowd was, you know, booing the president or the chairman rather, so they've always had problems and upheavals in the boardroom, and they've never had that sort of stability which Dortmund had twice during the era of Gerd Niebaum, the president under whom they won the Champions League, and now the current regime.
Well, let's conclude today's episode with try being a little productive. We've bashed on Schalke for the best part of an hour now. Guys, let's look at a hypothetical. Clemens Tone is the Schalke chairman, is out the door. We individually have taken his place. From next season on, how do we take this club, turn it around and move it forward towards challenging for Dortmund and Bayern? Ross, how would you go about it?
Well, I would first of all give free pies and free beer to everyone, just for populism. No, I'm kidding, obviously. I think certainly coaching is a big issue at Schalke, and you know, under Heidel they've had 8 different coaching tenures since 2011, which is pretty remarkable. Obviously some of those coaches have been in more than once, which is even worse to be honest, but that's a bit of a concern. It's been 19 since Clemens Tönnies came in 2001. I think if you look at all those appointments in the last, you know, 5-6 years, they've all been very short term moves. Jens Keller, Huub Stevens, De Matteo, Breitenreiter, even, because Breitenreiter will probably leave at the end of the season. I think a very key point in Schalke's recent history was Ralf Rangnick, because I think Ralf Rangnick was a great appointment. He did a very good job, you know, and obviously he had to leave 6 months into his tenure due to health reasons, which potentially is a massive turning point for Schalke in that point under Horst Held. I think one of the biggest problems for Schalke is that they're almost being held back by tradition a little bit, and I don't normally say that, because I do think tradition is a massive thing, and if you don't have tradition, then what do you have? But I think Schalke especially are being held back, because there's still this demand in Germany now that every coach has to be fluent in German. Every single coach has to deal with the media in the same way that native German speakers do. And I think you've got to be realistic. It's 2016. I think people in Germany obviously are very comfortable in English. I think English is a working language for most of these coaches. I think if you look at Pep Guardiola, does most of his coaching in English, and I'm sure that will be the same throughout the league, even with Breitenreiter at Schalke. I'm sure he'll do a lot of his coaching in English. So for me, I think you have to look outside of Germany. I don't see any coaches in Germany who would fit the bill at the moment. And I think that holds you back if you limit the talent pool to just German speakers. You don't really have a lot to play with, because there's not a lot of international guys who have come to Germany and have picked up German so well that they want to come back and coach. I think you have to look possibly at Spain, or maybe Italy for a coach who would come into Schalke. I think someone like Paco Gemes at Rayo Vallecano would be a great appointment. I think he's a really good coach. I think he would come with a new philosophy. I think players like Max Meyer and Leroy Sané would benefit so much with someone like that. Maybe someone like Frank de Boer from Ajax, possibly. You know, he's potentially going to leave in the summer. That's the kind of appointment that would be a bit different. So for me, I think you've got to open up the talent pool. You've got to recruit better. And obviously, certainly look for a coach who could be there in the long term. I think Marcus Weinziel potentially could be the coach. Obviously, we don't want to speculate on who it's going to be. But I think you probably have to look outside of Germany.
Yeah, I would agree with you there, Ross. But I think Marcus Weinziel would be the only one in Germany that I would consider being suitable for the job. I mean, I think Andre Breitenreiter was. I mean, we talked about it a lot personally between us at the start of the season about whether we thought he would be a success or not. And I personally thought, because he'd come from Paderborn, it's like Dirk Schuster taking over Schalke this year. I just don't think it would work. But I mean, going from Paderborn to Schalke, Champions League football, expecting to be right up there and deal with all this pressure of being such a huge club was just too much for him. Sadly, I think it was just too much for him at the wrong time. And I think Weinziel could deal with it a lot better because he has more experience. But I agree, they need to go. I think it didn't work with Di Matteo because he didn't have enough experience. But I think they need to go international. I was going to say Frank de Boer as well at one for one name, or a Philip Cocu from PSV. He hasn't got great experience in terms of actual managerial experience, but he's won a title now with PSV. There's a lot of unearthed coaches around there. I mean, you look at Bayer Leverkusen, who brought in Roger Schmidt from Salzburg. It's just a little coach like that who has his own philosophy, he knows how to play good football, and if he can work well with the sporting director who's willing to spend money in the right way, it can work. And I think Christian Heidel coming in from Mainz is great. I mean, you look at their managerial work over the last few years, Klopp, Tuchel, and now Martin Schmidt has taken them up there again into European football. So it's possible now with Heidel that they appoint the right man, but for me personally, it's got to be either Marcus Weinziel or, as you said, Ross, someone from overseas, someone who can try and bring sort of a fresh look to Schalke. Because as a big European player, you look at Schalke and think they're a good team with a lot of young talent, but would you want to go and play there? Because they're not able to compete with Dortmund and Bayern at the moment, and they're in the Europa League. So you need to try and get a big name or someone who knows how to play good football in a very secure and structured way.
Just want to make actually one random point. Like, if you look at the Deloitte Money League, you know, obviously Schalke are 13th. If you look at all the clubs in that list, there are not many clubs that have the barriers, the cultural barriers that Schalke are having to deal with tradition obviously being a big part of it. I mean, Juventus perhaps are the only other ones, because there's obviously Italians who are living in Italy, but there's not a huge international diaspora of Italians. And the same with Germans. I mean, Germany obviously has 60, 70, or 80 million speakers, whatever. You've got Austria, Switzerland, whatever. But it's not like with Atletico Madrid, when they can bring in an Argentinian coach like Diego Simeone. Do you know what I mean? Like, the Spanish diaspora, the Spanish influence is so great that the talent pool is so much bigger. Whereas with Schalke, you really don't have a lot of talent, because you're not going to appoint someone from Austria, probably not going to appoint someone from Switzerland. So you're really dealing with, what, you know, maybe 18, 20, 25 coaches who potentially could take over. And I mean, that's a pretty startling talent pool that they have to work with. So just go back to what I was just saying there. Yeah, for me, number one thing is open up the talent pool and recruit properly.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys have nailed this one right in the head. And all I can do is really echo your sentiment. I think Schalke really just have to be bolder with their aspirations. I think, you know, I just made the point that Schalke's youth system has worked in spite of Helt's best intentions at the club. And I may be about to contradict what I'm saying here, because I actually think the way that he's picked the managers has almost mirrored the way that Schalke and perhaps the league as a whole tends to curate talent. The Bundesliga is outstanding at offering an environment for young players and coaches to develop. They get far more time than, you know, they perhaps do in England, for undoubtedly, than they do in England. And that's obviously worked wonders for Schalke. And when you look at the coaches who've came in while he was there, you know, for example, Jens Keller or De Matteo. I know Jens Keller was a thingy coach. He wasn't an ideal one. But Jens Keller, De Matteo, and now Brighton Reiter, these are guys who haven't proved themselves. I know De Matteo had a Champions League medal by the time he arrived, but that's not the point. The point is that Hertz been a little. He's always been a little too cute with the way that he's signed these guys. He's constantly trying to find the coach who's not yet proven himself, but is on the verge of proving himself. He looks at the way that he hires coaches the same way that the clubs look at bringing in players. For example, Johannes Geis. They've signed Johannes Geis because they think in 5 or 6 years he's going to be a world-class player. And that's exactly what they thought Brighton Reiter or De Matteo were going to be when they hired them. I don't think you can really do that with coaches. I think you have to bring, if you're a club of Schalke's size, you have to bring in a coach who has proven himself, not only in terms of winning trophies, but proven himself in developing players. And that's the main problem that I have. Ross, you make a really good point about the fact that they seem determined to bring in German speakers. They maybe can get around that by bringing in someone like Lucien Favre, although he has his own complications as well. I don't know if they maybe want to hire him. And maybe down the right, down the road, maybe someone like Roger Schmidt at Leverkusen, if he could be tempted. But I completely agree. They have to open up the talent pool. They have to look outside of Germany, not just because they have to change the culture, but simply because I think they have to stop treating the managerial position like it's another spot on the squad. And I think they have to start, as soon as they bring in a coach who has a proven record and, you know, knows that he's there to win things rather than develop just like Leroy Sané or develop just like Max Meyer, then things will change. Felix Magath had that. He brought relative success to the club. Ralf Rangnick, to a certain extent, and Huub Stevens quite some time ago. These were coaches who, you know, they weren't on the up. They weren't young coaches who were fashionable, who were charming. These were guys who demanded success. And I don't think we've seen that at Schalke in quite some time. So at least if I was the chairman, that's the first thing I'd be looking to sort out. We need to stop being cute with our signings of managers. We need to bring in a bold managerial decision, a bold managerial coach who isn't going to try and be fashionable. He's just going to get the job done.
No, and I completely agree with that. And I think, again, I don't want to make the comparison to Dortmund too much again, but I think if you look at someone like Thomas Tuchel, who obviously Schalke were interested in, Thomas Tuchel had, you know, what, 6-7 years of development at Mainz. He took them into Europe. He stabilised them in the league. And obviously, as you said, you know, the guys like Jens Keller, who was a youth coach at the time, even guys like Slomka, who before he went to Hanover, Slomka was one of the coaches at Schalke before his success at Hanover. As you said, a lot of the guys they've brought in have got not really a great track record. And I'm interested to know, you know, certainly when they go through the recruitment process, you know, when they sit down and they look at candidates, you know, why would you bring in a Di Matteo or a Keller or some of that? I mean, surely Schalke attracts greater, you know, talent than that. I mean, I'm not disrespecting those guys, but certainly in terms of their track record and their CV, it's not great. And I think you're right. I think they've got to go for a bold appointment. And I know that they've taken risks in the past, but there's nothing wrong with taking risks as long as you have the structure in place and as long as it's a calculated risk. I mean, I'm sure someone like Diego Simeone has a bit of a loose cannon, and I'm sure the Atletico Madrid have looked at that and gone, okay, well, maybe that's a negative against him. But someone like that, I think, for Schalke would be ideal. I think they just need something different, and I think they've got to look outside of Germany for that. I don't really think there's any English coaches who would fit the bill. I think you've got to look maybe at Spain, the Netherlands, France, possibly. And I don't think this demand for German speakers is huge. I just think they have to, you know, pick their man, obviously based on the track record, and stick by him.
Well, guys, I'm glad we sorted that. Then, Schalke fans, you are welcome. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do leave us a review on iTunes, and you can leave us a ranking too. We have been completely and utterly blown away by the kind words we've had from people on Twitter and Facebook, by how much you guys have enjoyed the first two shows. We hope you enjoy this show as well. But do please continue to give your support to us. You can follow us on Twitter at Tribune Podcast, and we are also on Facebook under the exact same name. And please be sure to follow us again. We'll be on next week, same time, same place, with another episode. So thank you very much for listening.